and a very warm welcome to Political Economy with Shweta Punj, the podcast that gets you a breakdown of all the key policies that are shaping India today. Today, we are speaking about something very intriguing and something very fascinating. While a lot has been spoken and written and discussed about why the West hates India, in terms of the kind of coverage they give us, in terms of, you know, how they look at India, in terms of the kind of reports that come out talking about India, the latest one being on the inequality index and how India is more unequal now than ever before. We are taking this narrative further. Another side of India is that India has received the most amount of FII money coming into India. There is a lot of investor interest into India, especially in the last 2 years. Post-pandemic, the world is looking at India very differently. To explain what's working for India, what are the policies that have got the investor community excited and that have changed their perception about India, I have with me Samiran Chakrabarty, Chief Economist of the Citigroup. Samiran, thank you so much for joining us. So besides being an ace economist and a lot of data crunching that Samiran does, Samiran also interacts a lot and steers a lot of international clients and introduces them to the Indian economy and Indian polity. So who best to really understand this with Samiran? It's been, it's been an interesting last few years. There is never a dull moment in this country, right? And specifically post-pandemic, it's almost like India has been rewriting the rules when it comes to engagement with the world, whether it's foreign policy or whether it's economic policy. I just want you to give us a sense of how differently is the West looking at India now from an investment point of view.
Thanks, Shweta, for having me on your show. Let me start off by being a bit anecdotal and give you an impression of what is going on here. So there are two different kinds of investors that we can broadly classify. One is the foreign direct investments done by different multinational companies, and the other is the foreign portfolio investors who are putting money into Indian equities and Indian bonds, etc. And I'll give you a perspective on both of them. So on a lighter note for FDI, when I wear my hat of being Citibank's corporate bank economist, I can tell you that the number of incoming CEOs and CFOs that I've met over the last 1 year trying to redesign, reimagine their India strategy, it's probably the highest that I have ever seen in my working life of more than 2 decades. And if I think of the other variety, which is the portfolio investors, there two things strike to me as really important. One is that I don't have to sell India anymore to them. They are already pretty convinced about the structural positive story about India. And the second aspect is that I'm seeing increasingly newer geographies who are getting interested in investing in India, other than the traditional places from which we have already got investors. So a place like Australia or a place like Brazil is now interested in putting money into India because they have also understood that this is a game that they have to be in. So I think let's start off from there, just as a sort of initial point about how the different classes of investors are looking at India, and then we can probably take it forward on exactly what are the things that are exciting them.
Super. Thank you for that very comprehensive introduction to FDI money coming in, FPI money coming in. And it's very heartening to hear that you no longer have to sell the India story. There is a lot happening in India for them to get excited. And I'm assuming that they're coming to you and asking you, okay, how do we go about this? So let's begin with FDI, Samiran. Now, if I look back at the 10-year trajectory of this government and the ideological moorings of this government. Now, initially, this government was perceived to be very Swadeshi, and we've launched campaigns also, Make in India, and so on. But In the last two terms of the Modi government, the Indian economy has also opened up tremendously, right? It's more open now than it has ever been. We've got FDI being permitted in across all sectors, whether it's space, whether it's manufacturing and so on, which is very different from the point from the time I remember I had reported on insurance being opened up by Mr. Vajpayee. And there was a huge protest staged by the Swadeshi Jagran Manch protesting against this move, which was Swadeshi Jagran Manch is supposed to be the economic think tank of this government. So how much of those policies really helped, you know, in generating this FDI interest? So one hand is, you know, you open up a sector, and on the other, you supplement it with, you know, opening up or easing rules and so on. So how has that played out on ground?
So Shita, let me put it this way, that India has been gradually opening up to FDI for an extended period of time now. In fact, I would say that there's hardly any sector now which is not opened up to FDI. Mm-hmm. On top of it, what is changing is that I think it is almost unbelievable that India is now offering explicit fiscal subsidy to even multinational firms to produce in India, like an Apple or whatever. They're getting subsidies under the PLI scheme. This is, again, given that Swadeshi background that you were talking of, this would have been almost impossible to imagine. But beyond that, I think what companies are seeing is, one, there is a good runway of 10 years of substantially higher growth that is going to happen in this country. Most likely, it is going to remain the highest growth economy for at least a decade, if not more. That's a pretty comfortable thing. Second is that they're noticing that one of the concerns that they had about macro stability in India, that India often gets affected by high inflation, high fiscal deficit, high current account deficit, the currency depreciates significantly. They are now more comfortable that India has got a good grip on macro stability. We have demonstrated over the post-COVID period that all those boxes have got ticked now. Third is that there is a clear policy focus towards driving manufacturing. This has been missing in the past. We have not been wholeheartedly going for it. Now, whether it is building up the infrastructure to reduce the logistics cost, whether it is providing some subsidies under the PLI scheme, or whether it is trying to improve the ease of doing business by getting a lot of regulations simplified, from all aspects, the government has a much more focused emphasis on manufacturing. And within that, a subcomponent really is that India is not just doing the low-end labor-intensive manufacturing. It's actually focusing more on the high-end new economy kind of sectors. That's also very exciting for them. And lastly, I think the China Plus One is also a very important component in today's geopolitics. I think almost every company understands that they have to diversify. And if they are diversifying, then India automatically comes at the top of their list, given the size and scale that India can offer, the kind of human talent that India can offer. So because of all these reasons, I think the FDI side is quite convinced about getting their India game up. We can go in the latter stage to think that why we haven't yet seen that in numbers, but I'll try to explain at a later stage probably what is going on there as well.
Yeah, I would love to hear that, because India has always been like maybe a punishment posting for a lot of global bankers, for a lot of global investment firms. It's been a bit like an outpost, especially in the early 2000s, that all the global banks would be either London, New York, and that continues to hold true. So I want to, at a later stage, we can talk about that, whether Mumbai can become the next Singapore when it comes to attracting all this financial talent, and whether it can really emerge as a hub for Asia, which is something that Singapore has been. So you listed out a bunch of policies that have helped India. One is the macro stability, which you talk about. Second is this PLI scheme, where we are actually incentivizing MNCs to come and set shop. So let's go one by one. When it comes to macro stability, we are looking at currently a fiscal deficit of about 5%. That's the deficit we are working with. Since when did a 5% fiscal deficit become a good deficit number to have? I want you to explain this to me, because, you know, one would think it's a pretty high number. And fair enough, we live in an uncertain world. We've gone through a very devastating pandemic, and we've still come back. I would say we're still coming back stronger. So just explain that what about the macro stability that is most appealing to you and to the investors?
So two, three things here, Shweta. First is that unlike a lot of other economies, India did not do a significant demand stimulus post the pandemic. In everywhere, the governments were giving out cash handouts to people to stimulate demand, whereas India very consciously decided not to do those kind of things. So the widening of fiscal deficit to about 9.5% at the central government level after the pandemic was more because of reduction in taxes than actually a demand stimulus. Now, the investors are appreciating the fact that this 9.5% is becoming 5%. And I must add that in these kind of situations, the credibility of the government is extremely important. Every year, the government is meeting the fiscal deficit target that it is announcing, which is something which investors appreciate a lot. So that's where, when the government says that next year, not FY25, but FY26, this 5% will become 4.5% or below, I think people are not questioning that number that much. So the credibility of the fiscal number and the fact that we have not given a demand stimulus, they are being appreciated by the investment community and especially what is happening across the world. But I must also clarify a technical point here. The technical point is about fiscal transparency. The fiscal transparency issue is that in an odd way, today's 5% fiscal deficit would have been called 3.5% in pre-pandemic days. About 1.5% of GDP by our estimate of fiscal deficit is increase is just because some off-budget expenditure of the government, they have put it now on budget. Say, for example, NHAI, whatever they were borrowing from the market and spending on building roads and highways, that borrowing is not being done by NHAI anymore. The government is directly giving them that money from the central government's balance sheet. So it is showing up as a higher fiscal deficit, but is actually not, because technically, even pre-pandemic, that NHAI borrowing, the government was liable for it in some sense. That off-budget expenditure becoming on-budget expenditure is actually improvement in fiscal transparency. You know, we talk about this in the context of China, that they have all these local government debt, which is very difficult to identify. And that's why the true public debt situation is often quite unknown in China. We don't want these kind of situations in India. That's why we are showing much more transparency in putting whatever debt, whatever expenditure directly into the central government's balance sheet. And that's why probably the number is looking slightly higher. But like for like, I would take off about 1.5% of GDP from the fiscal deficit number to have a pre-COVID versus post-COVID comparison. And as you know, pre-COVID, we wanted to go to 3% of GDP. That was our target. So we are not too far off from that target now, is what my sense is.
Okay. So, you know, that's an interesting point that you raise about fiscal transparency in the numbers. Now, data, when it comes to data and quality of data, there has been some sort of controversy around it. There were reports that the earlier consumption survey was junked. There have been questions that have been raised on the quality of data that the government has been presenting. But as someone who tracks data indicators, you talk about how the government might have cleaned up the balance sheets completely and has come out and declared off-budget borrowings into the budget statement, which has given out a positive signal. Can you give us some context to this, Samiran, on when you say now there is more credibility associated with what India does and what India, you know, puts out as a budget document? How was it, say, maybe 10 years ago? So if you could just explain to us, you know, the kind of change that we have seen in this, in terms of the perception.
So it's like earlier, there would be initial days, you will recall, the petroleum subsidy used to be done in a very different way by issuing bonds to these companies, which were not directly part of the budget. Then came the food subsidy, where part of the FCI subsidies were directly borrowed by FCI, and again was not shown in the budget numbers. Then this NHAI type of thing, where even the highway spend was, you'd recall those articles used to come out that the NHAI's balance sheet is becoming too unwieldy, their borrowings are just too much compared to their revenues. So appreciating all these concerns, I think we have now streamlined on all these fronts. In fact, till a few years back, the government used to publish along with the budget one pager on extra budgetary borrowing. We don't need to publish that report anymore because there is nothing almost extra budgetary anymore. Everything is part of the budget. So what you see is what you get. That's a very good thing. That's very comforting for investors, because sitting outside India, it's very difficult for them to track all these fine points in different places to figure out exactly how much the fiscal stress is. So if they get to see everything in one place, I think that's a very fair achievement.
Okay. So let's talk about the FPI money now coming in. That's coming into equities and bonds. What's driving that interest into the country?
So let's start with one number, and that will tell you the big change that has happened. So the weight of India in the MSCI Emerging Market Equity Index used to be 8%. That has now become more than 18%.
In the last 2 years or in the last decade?
In last 3 years. Last 3 years.
Okay.
So you can imagine that that what is going on here is that a lot of these funds, their performance is indexed to this EM index. So if they are neutral on India, then they will have to put 18% of their funds into Indian assets. If they love India, they will put more than 18%. They will go overweight India. If they don't like India, they will go probably underweight, but still hold maybe whatever 14-15%. By underweight, you can't be going to 10% or below. Generally, people are not that underweight. So what I'm trying to say is that almost every fund tracking this index would be at least 15%, if not much higher, on their India weights. And that means that this is almost a very sticky money, because it does not every day you change it. So most foreign portfolio investors are having a core India position, which is becoming very large. We sometimes also hear that as a proportion of Indian market cap, the portfolio holdings, foreign portfolio holdings have come down. But that's just because the domestic money increase has been even at a faster pace than the foreign money. So it's not that the foreigners have taken out money. It is just that the domestic money has moved in even at a faster clip. Now, why they're getting into India? One is obviously what I mentioned in the FDI context also, that the runway for a high growth is very much visible to everyone. The second is that India offers a market which is very diversified. So if you go to, let's say, a Korean equity market, there are a handful of sectors which are present there. The technology sector, the semiconductor sector, same is there if you go to Taiwan or any other such market. In any case, those markets don't have as much market depth as India has. But India also offers a huge market breadth. Think of the number of sectors where there are large companies, investable companies. It's just a big attraction for them. And then the momentum also matters. The fact that Indian markets have performed much better than most of the EM. If you look at even mid-cap, small-cap, they've performed way, way better. So there is a tendency for investments to not just be in the large-cap space for India, which has been the story of the past. They're now more comfortable even getting into the mid-cap, small-cap kind of spaces as well, exploring that opportunity given the high growth that these are offering. So kind of just to summarize, I think it's a story of compulsion because of that weight increase. It's a story of promise because of that growth increase. And it's a story of diversity because there are just so many sectors and so many different kinds of stocks to play with. So given all this, I think the interest is quite strong on India at this moment, even from the foreign portfolio investor side. And that too, we have just talked about equity here. Bonds is a different story altogether, which is going to start from June.
Okay. So, you know, we've spoken about why the West loves India. Now, you also mentioned about the China Plus strategy, but we've also seen that a lot of those investments have gone to other countries. So they've not, all of them have not come into India. We are making our moves, but it's not all coming into India. Vietnam has emerged as a very formidable competition. Now that we are very close to general elections, Samiran, clearly the momentum is with us. Clearly the perception is right at the moment. What are the key things that you would like to see the government do as it forms another government in May? There is an expectation that the Modi-led government could come back. Do you have a wish list? Do you think, is there something that India should do to really, accelerate this investor interest into big investments coming into the country?
So before I answer your question in a more direct way, one very interesting analysis that we do is to do a web scraping exercise to find out how many companies are announcing their relocation plans out of China and in which countries they are going. So we have been doing this exercise from 2018 onwards. And from 2022 middle, I think that's the time when, for the first time, India started exceeding Vietnam. And for entire 2023, we have seen that trend that actually India has crossed Vietnam in the number of proposals from companies to shift out of China and where they want to go. We see this trend also in the UN data of FDI into greenfield projects. The balance of payment data on FDI is a bit confusing because it has everything, even private equity, venture capital, everything into it. And sometimes repatriation of these private equity, venture capital, they distort that data, which is why today the FDI numbers might not look that good for India. But if we just look at the greenfield FDI data, which UN provides, India is neck and neck with Mexico at the top. And far ahead of most of the other Asian countries. So that way, it gels with my perception of FDI speaking to our clients. Now, coming to your question on what more people want to see, I think in a nutshell, people want more ease of doing business. Now, this is a very generic term. In different sectors, it could have very different connotations, but it will also include some of the things which people like macroeconomists like us, we call structural reforms in the form of labor market reforms or land reforms. These are all, actually, they all boil down to ease of doing business for these companies. If it's easier for them to acquire land, if it's easier for them to have more flexibility in the labor market, all these things that help them plan their business better. I think this is an area where if we work more, I think most companies will have an even bigger allocation to India. We have a second problem, which is a more complicated problem. This is a problem of economies of scale. So, you know, China is head and shoulders above us on the scale of manufacturing. So just to give you one random example, I was speaking to a company which produces a plastic part for automobiles, which costs 3 rupees. But for them, it's cheaper for them to produce that part in their China factory and import it into India rather than producing it in their India factory.
Oh, what's the cost differential?
Because their scale of operations is so large in China that it just makes that one product much cheaper to produce there. So if they're thinking of incremental investment, would they do it in China or would they do it in India? Because definitely cost-wise, China would be cheaper. So how do we get companies to build up scale in India? Which is where I think these PLI kind of schemes become relevant, because while this cost arbitrage is there between India and other countries, the PLI can bridge this cost arbitrage to some extent. And people might be interested in putting, once we get that scale up in India, we probably don't need the PLI anymore. So we'll have that sunset clause on PLI. But for the time being, addressing this scale problem is something that we probably would have to consider as well.
Interesting. Okay. We will talk more about the agenda for the new government. We'll keep that for another episode. But I do want to ask you as my last question. By when do you think would a Mumbai or, say, a GIFT city, which has made tremendous progress in the last few years, when do you think would these cities emerge as, you know, a counter to, say, a Singapore or a London, when it comes to financial activity? When do you think would the global investment banks make India as their big Asia hub?
It's going to take time, Shweta, is my personal view, because once you set up certain centers, like how much Singapore has got established, or Dubai or Hong Kong, it's difficult to dislodge that. Because it's not just we can very well design policies to get the incremental flows into a GIFT city or into Mumbai. But the flow which is already there in Singapore, to dislodge that and bring it to India might be a more difficult exercise to do. So it will be a gradual process, is what my sense is. And I don't think anyone is in a hurry also to do it. Because let's face it, that our financial system, I'm not talking GIFT City, I'm talking the rest of India's financial system, is already so beautifully built that there is no inefficiency that the GIFT City is solving in some sense. If you think of a foreign portfolio investor into Indian equities, can do practically anything that he wants, even in the current setup. So what is the additional incentive for that person to go to GIFT City? So on the margin, there could be small things here and there, but the broad structure of our financial system is so streamlined and so modern now. We're thinking of even going T plus zero on our settlement. I mean, I think no major country I know of has even tried that. So that way, the development of the financial hubs is, I think, very, very good in India at this moment. But can we be able to dislodge a Singapore or a Dubai? I think that's going to take time.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much, Samiran, for breaking down the India story for us. We get so much flack on inequality in our country, on poverty levels, this, that. So it's just good to get the view from the other side, someone who is constantly working with numbers and someone who's constantly working with investors. And you are actually no longer selling the India story, but making the India story happen. Thank you so much, and a big thank you to all our viewers and listeners for tuning in. Keep coming back for more as we keep debriefing India's big policies that are shaping our economy and our polity. Thanks so much for watching.